standing at the station and I'm waiting on my train to come. Well, I'm standing at the station and I'm waiting on my train to come. I can't stand around all day, you know I gotta run.
Hello, I'm Todd DeFeo, publisher and editor of railfanning.org. Earlier this year, I spoke to the Georgia Archives about my book on the Atlanta Northern Railway. I took an opportunity to focus on some happenings I researched at the State Archives and the difficulty in determining the facts of history. Although my presentation primarily focused on an interurban rail line, as I mentioned in my remarks, the story of the Atlanta Northern parallels the stories of so many railroads and the challenge of researching history. I often say that railroads are about more than rolling stock and rails. They are the stories of people. Sometimes those stories are funny, while other times they're tragic. In the case of the Atlanta Northern, I began my presentation by highlighting a tragedy to illustrate the cross-section of people who relied on the line. It also illustrated how one moment in time has the power to change lives forever. I wanted to share some highlights from that presentation. This information is evergreen, and it's as compelling today as when I presented it. I do mention some data in this presentation, so please visit the podcast's page on railfanning.org for relevant charts. This podcast is an edited and condensed version of my presentation. I hope you enjoy.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'm particularly excited to be talking about the Atlanta Northern Railway. Before I jump too far into the presentation today, I'd be remiss if I didn't take a moment to say how important the Georgia Archives is and the many stories that it holds within its walls. I visited the archives twice while writing my book on the Atlanta Northern, and the information I gathered here was indispensable to the story. What's fascinating about researching railroads is that often there's a distinct lack of facts. It sounds funny. What happened, happened, and it should be undeniable. But history has a funny way of obscuring the past. Official records sometimes lack clarity. Newspaper accounts may be unreliable. People's recollections are hazy. But that's what makes telling a story such a fun challenge to tackle. As I begin my presentation today, I wanted to start with a story about a catastrophe that transpired on the railroad. It was an event that I researched here at the archives. Perhaps now is also the time to mention that I have a knack for beginning or ending my presentations on a macabre note. To set it up, I want to turn back the clock to the morning of January 2nd, 1928. On that day, two trolleys, the Joseph E. Brown and the Lemuel P. Grant, collided. Both trolleys, of course, were named for famous Georgians, and they crashed in the Jonesville community. If you're familiar with Cobb County, and specifically the area between Smyrna and Marietta, Jonesville was a community located along Atlanta Road, more or less at the end of Dobbins Runway today. Ultimately, six people were killed in the tragedy. But rather than focus on it from a railroad operation perspective and talk about the ensuing investigation and who was responsible, I wanted to use the crash as a window into the era and talk about the people who depended on the Atlanta Northern Railway. The six people who were killed in the wreck should be remembered, even if history has largely forgotten them. The six people who died range in age from 33 years old to 50 years old. They lived in Atlanta, Marietta, and in and around Smyrna. Meyer Lutsk and Louis Melender were merchants. Elmira White and Carrie McIntyre were housewives. Everett Moon and George Hudson worked for either the Atlanta Northern or its parent company, a small little outfit that we know today as Georgia Power. As an aside, you can find the six people killed in the wreck in historic cemeteries across the metro Atlanta area, including Oakland Cemetery. But there are others involved in the wreck. They range in age from 15 years old to their mid-50s. They were school teachers, mill workers, truckers, farmers, greenhouse workers, and many more. They were brought together at a moment in time. They are a part of history and the Atlanta Northern story. You see, a railroad is more than the rolling stock and the tracks. It's a story about communities. It's a story about mobility. And it's ultimately a story about people. And sometimes it's a story about tragedy. And it's about how tragedy strikes, and in a sheer bit of callousness, the world moves on and we forget those stories. We forget the people. Sometimes we even forget the places where these tragedies happen. Just consider Jonesville. I think it's fair to say few people today know of this community, nearly lost the history. From the railroad perspective, the Atlanta Northern took the wreck in stride, sadly. It was a cost of doing business, a literal cost, in that they paid the victims of the wreck, and it eventually fell from the headlines. To give you an insight into how the Atlanta Northern viewed it, a VP of the company sent a letter to the insurance company shortly after the wreck and said, if there could be anything fortunate about the accident, it consists in the fact that all of the dead and injured belong to the middle class. There being none of the high earning capacity or more than ordinary standing in the respective communities where they live. rather coldly put. But I share this story, this quote in particular, because it highlights the intersection of an institution like the Atlanta Northern and the people it served. Now, before we go too much deeper into the story, I wanted to give you a little bit of context about the Atlanta Northern and the time that it ran. The railroad began service in July of 1905, and it operated between downtown Atlanta and the Marietta Square, and it ran until early 1947. You can see the Jonesville tragedy on there in 1928. Shortly after that, the Great Depression came along. The Atlanta Northern survived the Great Depression. It exited into the World War II era, and it emerged as a vital transportation link. But ultimately, by the time we got to World War II, the best days of the Atlanta Northern were behind it. And in quintessential Atlanta fashion, we opted for the motor vehicle, the enemy of the Atlanta Northern throughout its four decades of operation. In presentations about this line, I usually talk about the notion of commuter rail or mass transit. People will often say or ask a question, maybe one day Cobb County will have a mass transit option. When will we have more trains than Cobb County? And if you can believe it, once upon a time, the area actually had two options. We're talking about the Atlanta Northern today, but it also had the Western and Atlantic Railroad. I think it's probably safe to assume that more people have heard of the Western and Atlantic. The state-owned railroad is still there, running between Atlanta and Chattanooga, Tennessee. But paralleling that line is the line we're going to be focusing on today. It was the Atlanta Northern, and it operated for four decades. Now, some of the stops changed over the years, and there were changes to a specific route, but it generally followed what we know today as Atlanta Road. It passed through cities such as Smyrna, but it also served many smaller communities, such as Jonesville, like I mentioned a moment ago, Fair Oaks, Gilmore, Vinings, Bolton. Some of these communities barely exist anymore. They've been subsumed by urban sprawl and the growth of Atlanta, Smyrna, and Marietta in particular. And as I alluded to a moment ago, the line competed with automobile traffic and had constant run-ins with motor vehicles and jitneys throughout its history. At times, these run-ins caused serious consternation to the officials at the Atlanta Northern. And that was clearly the case on January 14th, 1925. So if we can imagine, it's a cold January morning, and you're one of about 1,500 commuters who shows up to catch the morning streetcar into town. And instead of finding a streetcar rumbling down the tracks, you see a notice hanging on the streetcar stop. And it said, the line has closed. Think about it, 1925, not everybody had a car. We didn't have Uber, so we couldn't flag down a rideshare vehicle. How are you supposed to get to your job? Perhaps you could turn to the Western and Atlantic Railroad, but it illustrated the importance of a line like the Atlanta Northern. It really was a vital transportation link, and its cessation of service was a real problem. But that's precisely what happened on this morning, January 14th, 1925. Why would the line take such a drastic action? I've never run a railroad myself, but I can imagine if you're trying to have customer service, this is not the right way to go about it. Well, the Atlanta Northern said unfair bus competition on lines paralleling car tracks had forced abandonment of schedules. Another way we could put that is there was too much competition from these newfangled buses, and the Atlanta Northern, the officials threw up their arms and said, we're not going to run our streetcars anymore. But it was more than just not running streetcars. The Atlanta Northern workers cut the overhead trolley wire. They tore up a section of track, and all the trainmen working on the line were assigned to sister lines. They had shut down the line. Did they really have a point for taking this drastic action? Like every argument throughout history, it depends on whose perspective it is. But ultimately, it was due to something that Preston Arkwright, the president of the Atlanta Northern, said was the degradation of the automobile, the jitney. You see, in the 1920s, what was happening in this era was the rise of the automobile and road improvements. And streets like Atlanta Road were starting to be paved. And in Atlanta, there was this huge showdown between streetcars and the jitneys. Now, a jitney is essentially somewhere between a taxi and a bus. It's more or less an open-air taxi that maybe should have 5 or 10 people in it, but probably carry 20 or 30 people in it. So there were more people riding in it than probably should have. And in short, the Atlanta Northern's concerns came down to street repairs. Their perspective was, we're paying a lot of money in taxes and franchise fees, and cities and counties are using this money to improve the streets. Then what happens? Our competition comes in, uses these streets, They're benefiting from our improvements, but they're not paying the same taxes. It's just not very fair. It sounds a lot like the fight that we have today, or have had in recent years, between taxis and ride-sharing companies. Taxis are a long-standing means of transportation. Suddenly there's new technology comes on, and we can have something like Uber or Lyft, and then the taxi companies complain. Their competitors aren't paying the same taxes. They don't have the same insurance regulations and requirements. In other words, they're held to a different standard. And it was the same argument in 1925, which should go to show you that history really does repeat itself. And if we don't learn from the past, we will definitely repeat it. And this fight really came down to two people, Newt Morris and Preston Arkwright. I mentioned Preston Arkwright a moment ago. He was the president of the Atlanta Northern. Newt Morris was an attorney in Marietta. Newton Augustus Morris, Judge Morris, as he was usually known. We could spend days discussing Newt and his history. He was born in 1869. He was a native of Cherokee County, went to the University of Georgia. He was prominent in Democratic politics, played a role in the Leo Frank lynching, served as a speaker of the Georgia House of Representatives. He was a judge, hence the name Judge Morris. But in his capacity as a lawyer, he had several run-ins over the years with the Atlanta Northern. But when the Atlanta Northern stopped running streetcars, he elevated his fight. He filed a lawsuit. And what ultimately happened was an incredible turn of events, one that really illustrates the power that a company like the Atlanta Northern had over local communities. Now, we still see this happen today when you think of companies moving in or making demands for tax breaks and certain benefits to relocate a company there or to expand their facilities. But this is exactly what happened in 1925. At first, the Marietta Chamber of Commerce tried to persuade the Atlanta Northern to resume its service. Morris was on the board of the Chamber of Commerce, so he stymied those efforts. And ultimately, Atlanta Northern officials said they wouldn't operate their streetcars unless they had assurances from city officials to bar buses from operating on streets where the Atlanta Northern did. That seems like a pretty big demand when you think about it. Dear city, please eliminate the competition. Shows the power the Atlanta Northern had, because city officials gave in and gave the railroad what it wanted. They stepped in, passed an ordinance barring bus operations on the same streets as streetcars. And largely behind this effort was a gentleman I mentioned a moment ago, Preston Stanley Arkwright, born in Savannah, 1871. He too was a lawyer. He married the daughter of a former Georgia governor, Alfred H. Colquitt. And he was the head, starting in 1902, of this small little outfit, the Georgia Railway and Power Company, and several of its successor companies over the years. He held the post until May of 1945 and died the following year. Oh yeah, I should mention those successor companies over the years. That's what we know today as Georgia Power. Now, I mentioned this fight between jitneys and the Atlanta Northern that spanned months. Ultimately, the Atlanta Northern won the fight and it resumed its service. And Arkwright, for his part, might have viewed the fight as one of the hits that the railroad would have to take as part of its operation. Consider what he said in January 13, 1925, that same year, in a speech before the retail food dealers of Atlanta. "Now, in the service of the community, that is just the job we do with the street railroad. There's nothing spectacular about it. There's nothing brilliant about it. There's nothing generous in it. There is no flash about it. It is there every day and night, week in and week out, year after year, performing the work of necessity for the community. And like everyone else who does that kind of job, we don't get the rewards out of it." Certainly, a contentious legal fight was not a reward that Arkwright or anyone at the Atlanta Northern would have wanted. But remember that notion of in the service of the community, because what I want to do next, delve a little bit deeper into the Atlanta Northern and the idea of community. When we look at this area today, I think we tend to forget that there were individual communities up and down the line. It today is more or less urban sprawl between Atlanta and Marietta. It's all developed. And I think maybe we think of the agriculture that used to be here, and the agriculture, the farms, and that type of industry, but we don't tend to think of some of the heavier industry that was in the area over the years. But I wanted to just call out two of them that were really integral to this area. The first is the Glover Machine Works. This is a locomotive builder that produced 200 steam locomotives in the early 20th century. And if you want to delve deeper into Glover's history, you should check out the Southern Museum in Kennesaw. They have the company's records and artifacts. Full disclosure, I'm on the board of the museum, but it is a fascinating company to explore. The other is the Bell Bomber plant. And that was the plant that emerged during World War II. They built the B-29 aircraft that helped the country win World War II. But I delved a little bit deeper to get into Preston Arkwright's thinking about who the writer of the Atlanta Northern was and who their communities were that they served. And he went around and would give a lot of speeches to different civic organizations in the 1920s in particular. And in 1922, ironically, he spoke to the Atlanta Automobile Association, and he summed up the persona of the streetcar rider, saying, "The rider is generally unable to own an automobile. He is made up from the less wealthy class of the community. He makes no use of the pavement, and yet he is compelled to pay for it." So even a few years before the showdown with the jitneys, he was talking about being compelled to pay for it and pay for pavement that the rider's not using. I mentioned at the beginning the notion of mobility. And I think today we tend to take mobility for granted. But the people in 1925 surely didn't take mobility for granted. And a rail link such as the Atlanta Northern helped open the suburbs for development. I mentioned a few minutes ago this notion or the question about Cobb County and a mass transit system. And I find it so fascinating when we look back and we realize what we had, something like a mass transit system, that people didn't always take it in the numbers that perhaps we think they did. And you can see the numbers went up steadily until about 1920. And then in 1920, the numbers started to dip. 1920, almost a full decade before the Great Depression. And certainly by 1930, the numbers continued to go down until about 1933. Then they started to come up again modestly. But they never really rose to that level again until we hit 1941 and 1942, 1943, World War II. We talked a moment ago in 1925 with the rundown with jitneys, is you can really see how automobiles, when they came on the scene and all these road improvements were taking place, it caused a direct downward decline of ridership. Certainly the continued decline in the 1930s is understandable considering the Great Depression. But even in this decade, the threats from buses continued to grow. And the Atlanta Northern even looked at converting its line for use for motor coaches. There were several bus companies that explored operations in the area, and there was one gentleman in particular who was pretty aggressive about it. His name was J.C. Steinmetz. Hang on to that name for a minute. But even in this era, the Atlanta Northern grew suspicious of competing bus operations. They thought they were somehow cheating the rules and regulations that were there, and they even ran some undercover operations to see if they could catch them in the act. But ultimately, whether it was the competition or any other headwinds, one of the biggest complaints that Atlanta Northern officials had throughout the history of the line was that the railroad didn't make a lot of money. Some years it did fairly well, but even by 1910, it had already a year in the red and went back up again. And in the 1920s, even though the ridership numbers had gone down, you could see actually the revenue numbers were a little bit better, but they still declined. And certainly by the 1930s, the railroad was in a perilous financial shape. But much like the ridership numbers, you can see by the end of the 1930s and into the 1940s, the numbers continued to rise. And ultimately what happened in the 1940s, in the start of World War II, the global conflict breathed new life into the line. It built an extension to serve the Bell Bomber plant, and it went in as far as bringing in new streetcars to augment its service. The ridership and revenues continued to increase. But despite the positive news and the positive outcomes that it might report, in some ways, the best days of the Atlanta Northern were already behind it. And to some degree, I think company officials knew that. They started discussing and entertaining options from different folks who were interested in buying the line. One of those potential suitors was the Seaboard Airline Railroad. Now, despite these conversations and back and forth discussions, there was no purchase of the line immediately. And the Atlanta Northern continued to operate on its own through World War II. But shortly after, in 1946, the railroad sold itself. It was purchased by a gentleman I mentioned a moment ago, J.C. Steinmetz. He was a bus promoter in the area and was responsible for a lot of coach lines in and around Atlanta, suburban coach lines. And once he bought the railroad, even if he initially said he wasn't going to just close it down immediately and convert it to bus operations, once he bought it, the end was near. It was really just a matter of when. And that when came at the end of January, 1947. The Marietta community turned out in droves to celebrate this line. And the city held a civic celebration to commemorate the line's history. And a bit of irony, perhaps, the new buses that would soon be replacing the streetcar lines were on display throughout the Marietta Square. And interestingly enough, on that final streetcar, which operated past midnight, so into February of 1947, there were at least six riders who were on the very first run 42 years earlier. I found a quote from W.F. Edwards. He was the superintendent in charge of transportation. He spoke at the event, and I think he aptly summed up the history of the Atlanta Northern. And he said, for 42 years, the Marietta line has served you. I believe you will agree that it served you well. It helped a great deal to build Marietta and the other communities, especially in the early days. It was indispensable to your progress. During the war, it did its part in providing essential transportation for you and the Bell Bomber workers. Now it is outmoded and goes the way of everything that has passed its best days of usefulness. Well, that was the end, perhaps, of the Atlanta Northern. That's not the end of our story today. Certainly, so much of the Atlanta Northern, its line and its infrastructure, has been lost to time and modern development. There are still some remnants of the line that you can see today. Trolley Line Park off Atlanta Road in Vinings. That commemorates a portion of the railroad's former right-of-way. An office building in downtown Marietta at the intersection of Church and Hansel Streets. And that's actually the former railroad's car barn in Marietta. What's now part of the King Plow Parts District is the former Ashby Street car barn of the Atlanta Northern. It's where they park the cars at night, and today it's an office building. I think there's some lofts in there as well. But as I put together presentations, and this one in particular, I started thinking about the legacy of the Atlanta Northern. It's a legacy that is similar to so many railroads throughout history. It's stories. The Atlanta Northern touched the lives of so many people during the four decades it operated. It helped people go about their daily lives. It gave mobility to communities up and down the line. In several instances, like the 1928 Jonesville tragedy I referenced at the start of my talk, the line forever changed the lives of families. Maybe the legacy of the Atlanta Northern is an opportunity for us. It's an opportunity to explore our past. History is a puzzle. The pieces are all there. But sometimes we only focus on one part of the puzzle. When we do, we fail to see the big picture. We fail to see how every part of the puzzle helps build the overall image we see when all the pieces are in place. I firmly believe the same is true for history. Our story today would not have been possible if not for the events of yesterday. And it's up to us to find those stories. It's up to us to take the time to open up the boxes in the state archives and look through the old records. We have the opportunity to find the stories from the past that speak to us, and we can bring them to life for a new generation. Stories are only forgotten because we've chosen to forget them, or we can choose to explore them and consider how they help shape the communities we know today and the lessons that they might hold for tomorrow.
I hope you enjoyed this presentation. For railfanning.org, I'm Todd DeFeo. Be sure to visit railfanning.org for more news, features, and photos from the rails.